Hey everyone, and welcome back to week two of Jews Numerology. Hope to continue our discussion of lucky numbers and the exceptions. What kind of numbers one is, what numbers are okay within Judaism, and specific examples of lucky numbers. I'm going to mute everybody by default. I'm getting a little bit of background noise. I'm going to put the link in the chat again for the source sheet since I've noticed some more joining. So this is a 3-week class, so we'll hopefully have another session next week. I'm not entirely sure what we'll be doing within the numerology topic. It depends on how far we go today. I have a few different ideas for which way we could go with it, so we'll see. Also, two other notes. This afternoon or evening, when I send out the follow-up email from today, I will include the flyer for registration for the January course. That's the problem with these 3-week series. Like, you finish one and the next one is right there. And you have to promote it, you know, when you're at week two of the previous one. Nonetheless, our January series is on the biblical Hannah, or Hannah, fighter and prophet. We'll be learning the stories involving Hannah. She's an incredible, incredible person, and we'll be learning her prayer, her poem. So that should be fun. So I'll send that out this afternoon, and it's open for registration. That series is a 3-week series also, and it starts January 10th. So is it 10th? Is that the 10th? It's the second Wednesday in January, whatever the second Wednesday in January is. That's what it is. Okay, and the second note I wanted to make is a little bit of a change in the way that that we're doing the class. Something that I've tried in my Tuesday and Thursday classes that's had success there. I didn't really want to do it here, but I think it's actually becoming necessary in a good way. Thank God we have many people, and many people with a lot of questions and comments and ideas, and that's great. But I've gotten a couple of requests from people to assign specific times for the questions and comments as opposed to doing it all through the session. Personally, I prefer it all through the session. I find I learn from the comments and questions that people offer, you know, as I'm speaking. Nonetheless, I have found with the other classes that I mentioned that it does help everybody learn better if it's, you know, sort of at a defined time. So that's what I'm going to try going forward. We'll see how it goes. If you take a look at the sheet, and I put the link again in the chat, if you look at source number 4 on the, actually, you know what, we'll do it in order. We're not going to jump to 4, we're going to start from 1. Last week, when we talked about lucky numbers, we saw that the Torah has a prohibition against reading omens, interpreting omens. If an event happens that has no practical relevance to your plans, and you read it as, this is a sign, I should do this, I shouldn't do that, that's a problem within the Torah. So if I'm planning on going to the store, and I walk outside and I see a snail on the, enough beating up on the black cats, I see a snail sitting on the pavement, and I say, oh, that's a sign that I shouldn't go. You know, snails are slow, and this is some kind of a message that I should slow down, or something like that, then that's inappropriate. I shouldn't rely on seeing a snail. The snail has nothing to do with anything. As opposed to, I go outside and I see that there is a cloud, it looks like it's going to start raining. That's not reading an omen. That's, you know, the type of information that you should take into consideration. It's not reading an omen for you to look at the traffic light before you cross the street. That's, you know, kind of important. So it's irrelevant things that you're not supposed to look at. And we gave a couple of explanations for why one should not look at omens. One explanation is that it can lead you to idolatry. You're looking at omens and signs, and you're looking to something other than God for your guidance. We had a debate as to whether omens might be meaningful, but you're not supposed to use them, or whether omens are meaningless altogether. But that was one school of thought. And then the other school of thought was, as Maimonides put it, it's silly. It's foolish, and it's a desecration of God's name for a Jew to do things that are foolish. Oh boy, we have a long list of things to work on. But that's the second idea. Somebody who listened to the recording online sent me a source. I knew about this, but I couldn't remember where I had seen it, where Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik was asked a question about hypnotism, and he discussed a few things. He discussed a variety of practices, and he said also it's prohibited for a Jew to do things that are foolish. So we then saw two stories in Tanakh in which apparently righteous people seem to be using omens, seem to be using signs. One was the story of the servant of Abraham who went to find a wife for Isaac, and he is supposed to find a girl from the family, but he pleads with God for an omen, which is apparently irrelevant, that he's going to choose the girl who comes to the well and who, when he asks her for water, offers water and for his camels. And the second one was the story of Jonathan, the son of King Saul, who wants to launch an attack on a Philistine outpost, and he tells his aide, we're going to reveal ourselves to the Philistines, and if they say come up, we'll take that as a sign that we are going to be successful. And we ask, how could these two cases be okay? These are righteous people. What was the justification? And we ended up with three exceptions to the prohibition. Three cases in which irrelevant signs or apparently irrelevant signs are acceptable. Number one, if you see the sign as coming from God, so it's not going to take you away from your loyalty to God. If you see it as coming from God, so Eliezer, the servant of Abraham, says to God, if this happens, I'm going to take it as a sign from you that this is the right girl. That's one. Second, if these aren't signs, these aren't omens, but rather they're actually meaningful events in their own right. So if Jonathan hears the Philistines say, come up, he takes that as a sign that they are weaker than they seem to be. They're afraid to abandon their high ground, and therefore he feels we can beat them. And then third, we said, if you're not really acting based on the sign, but you just use it for a psychological boost, makes you feel good. So we said, for example, in the story with Jonathan, he's telling his aide, this is going to be our sign, but he knows what they're going to say. Of course they're going to say come up, because they don't want to abandon their high ground. He's just using that as a way to convince the aide, look, God is on our side. That was our third exception to the rule. Wow, it took us an hour last time to get to that. Okay, so what I want to do, as I said in the beginning, is to apply these exceptions to find Judaism's, so to speak, lucky numbers. So exception number one, which we started on last time, is numbers that get their meaning from God. And we have a tradition of seeing numerological messages in the Torah, seeing numbers in the Torah as significant. The first three sources on your source sheet are holdovers from last time on that point, where we talked about something called remez, a layer of interpretation of the Torah, which carries messages, and we gave a specific example of it called gematria. If you take a look at source number four, okay, did everyone have the source sheet now? I posted the link again in the chat, so hopefully everybody saw it, everybody got it in email, however you got the sheet. So source number four on the sheet is just a table of the letters of the Hebrew alphabet and their numerical values. And it's a straightforward code for the most part. For the most part. The reason I say for the most part is because, you know, everybody at some point in grade school comes up with a brilliant idea of communicating in code, right, in English. So you say A is 1 and B is 2 and C is 3 and you go all the way through Z, or in this country Z, and you say Z is 26. So the Hebrew alphabet doesn't quite work that way on the gematria system. Instead, you go 1 to 9, the letter Tet is 9, Yud is 10, and then you move over to the second spot, and now it becomes 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. So you don't have a Hebrew letter that corresponds to the number 11. If you're working with a base 10 system, which means that if you want to do 11, so you do 10 and 1. you would do the letter Yud is your 10, and then the letter Aleph is 1. If you want to do 12, you would do the letter Yud, and then Bet, right? That's hopefully somewhat familiar. And then your next letter, which is the letter Kaf, will be 20. And then 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. The letter Kuf is 100. And then your next one, the letter Resh, is 200, and then 300, and then 400. Now, the Hebrew alphabet also has what are called final letters. Mem, Nun, Pei, Tzadi, and Kaf all have final letters, which are the different form of the letter that we use at the end of the word, why it has it, why only for those, a great discussion for another time. We could do a session sometime on the Hebrew alphabet. But those are also given their own numerical values over the 400. I just figured, let's stick with this. It made for a nice table and we're good. We're going to be using it a little bit today, so I wanted to make sure that you'd have the table here in front of you. But in terms of this system that we call gematria, this is considered to be okay under exception one. These are numbers which we believe receive their message from God, and therefore it's about a focus on God. There's no concern about leaving God for something else. And I'll give you an example. An example is the number 26. Anybody know what the number 26 represents in Judaism?
The number of letters of the alphabet.
Nope, we got 22.
Yud, K, Vav, K.
Ah, good. So Hannah says, Yud, K, Vav, K. What Hannah is talking about is, you'll see it in source number 5, I put it in Hebrew, but I didn't write it the way that it would be written in a Torah. It's the letter Yud, the letter He, the letter Vav, and then the letter He. That's a four-letter name of God. Don't write that down, please, because it is a name that is not supposed to be erased. In the event that you have it in writing, you know, obviously if it's in a book of the Torah, if it's in a Siddur, you're fine. But if you have it and you want to get rid of it, it has to be buried. You're not allowed to destroy it. So that's why I didn't put it on the source sheet. I figured, why sabotage everybody who prints out their source sheet? What's usually done is if people want to write it out, they will substitute the letter He for a different letter, a letter Dalet, a letter Kuf, something else, in order to avoid it, or they'll put a dash between some of the letters in the name. But it is true, as Hannah said, that 26 is the numerical value of that name of God. However, it actually has another meaning. And the next meaning of the number 26, which is associated, as we'll see, is what we call in Hebrew, Parnassa. Parnassa means livelihood. That's the number 26. Where do I get that from? Take a look at source number 5, please. Rabbeinu Bachya ben Asher wrote a commentary to the Torah, which veers into mysticism somewhat, called Karakemach. And here, this is from an essay of his about Pesach, about Passover. He talks about Psalm 136. In Psalms, in Tehillim, Psalm 136 is unique. For those who are familiar with either the traditional Shabbat morning davening, or this is said at the Seder, so people might know it from there. It's usually printed in two columns. The first column changes with each line. The second column is the same every time. The second column ends in Hebrew, Ki Le'olam Chasdo. Every line ends, Ki Le'olam Chasdo, Ki Le'olam Chasdo, Ki Le'olam Chasdo. In English, it's usually translated something like, His kindness is forever. There are 26 lines in that psalm, which I mentioned is used for Hallel. So take a look at source number 5, Rabbeinu Bachya, who explains the meaning of this psalm. He says, Psalm 136 mentions and describes the wonders of God among the creations, meaning that which God created. It speaks primarily of creation. It talks about God's kindness as the creator of the world, and the exodus from Egypt, and the splitting of the sea, and the wonders in the wilderness and in the land of Israel, and regarding exile and redemption therefrom, and regarding livelihood. Parnassa, which is a most important principle. So he says this psalm, Psalm 136, which is so important that it's said at the Seder on Passover night, has a focus on historical events, leaving Egypt and so on, but also on God supporting people. And he goes on to say, this psalm has 26 verses, and each one ends, "For his kindness is forever." This is the value of the unique divine name, as we just said, this number 26, and the number of the 26 generations from creation of the world until the presentation of the Torah. Meaning, if you were to count the begats, you would find there are 10 generations from Adam and Eve until Noah. There are 10 generations from Noah until Abraham. And then you start counting and you have Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Levi, Kehat, Amram, and then Moshe, Moses. You'll get 26. You can do it at home. I didn't actually count it, but I believe it is true. You have 26 generations until the Torah is presented. What's the point? Why does that matter? As he continues to say, because these generations then are just existing without fulfilling a Torah, without a covenant with God. By what merit do they continue to exist? God's generosity, God's kindness. And so he talks about the psalm, how it starts by describing creation of the world and the things that God does, all the way until we receive the Torah. So the point here is that the number 26 is meant to represent divine kindness and support for his creations, even when they don't deserve it. Do you follow? It is not considered an inappropriate lucky number, because it's actually God's message to us, as expressed in the Psalms here, and as expressed in the value of the divine name. I'll give you another example. The number 36. 36. What does 36 represent to you? Sorry?
Double chai.
Double chai, right? Twice chai. Twice chai. Chai, of course, being 18, life. Twice chai is 36. Well, 36 is taken to mean a double message of life, meaning life in this world and life in the next world. That's the idea. And we use it that way for prayer. As an example, we just had Hanukkah. If you take a look at source number 6, one who is careful with Hanukkah candles will merit life in this world and the next world. And so the text of Hanerot Halalu, that's that paragraph that people say after lighting the menorah, right? There are various tunes for it, which follows lighting, has twice 18 words. It has 36 words. To hint that one who is careful with Hanukkah candles will merit life in two worlds. Parenthetically, if you go home and you are home. I keep forgetting we do these on Zoom. But if you were to actually open a Siddur and count, you wouldn't necessarily find 36 words in it. Ezer Diena from my Beit Midrash gave a class a while back on this topic of the word count in that paragraph and the different versions of it over time. And I gave you the link at the end of source number 6, so you can listen to his session on that. But the point here is that we take 36 as a message from God about life. So if a person wants to focus on life, you have 18, like we talked about last week, the donations after the earthquake in Japan. And we also have the supercharged 36. Very good. Questions and comments so far? Janine?
Just that the other 36 is there are 36 candles if you don't count the Shamash.
Right. And that's also brought in the discussions about Hanerot Halalu, 36 candles. We also have other uses of 36 that don't seem directly relevant, like the idea of the 36 hidden righteous people in whose merit the world exists. We have other uses. Numbers are multi-purpose. We're allowed to have more than one resonance for a number. Okay. Other comments and questions?
The words, we're interpreting it, not necessarily.
That's where I'm going next. Marilyn is hitting on where I'm going next with this, which is, when is a number a message from God, and when is a number something that we are investing meaning in ourselves? I'm getting there. Mark.
Is there any source for the 18? Is it biblical and Talmudic rabbinical, or is it just sort of like a cultural thing?
Right. So I actually went looking when I was preparing this session to see how early I could find the idea that we should look at 18 as representing that. And it's very unclear. It's extremely unclear. Part of the problem is the printing press and the work of publishers, by which I mean there's a common practice in books to, when you have a number 18, instead of doing it the way it should be normally, which is Yud and then Chet, to reverse it, to do Chet and then Yud. And you find it in some very old texts, but the question is that original, or was that done later on? You know, by somebody going back and doing that. So I don't know. Moish.
I'm very bothered by this idea that until the Torah was given, the world existed by God's beneficence, because it would strike me that the world existed by virtue of humanity's morality. And why would we need anything more than that? And why would we need God's beneficence?
So you know, when I said it, I was thinking Moish is going to call me on this. So thank you for not disappointing. The answer in brief is that if you look at the Torah's account of the morality of the people in that period before the giving of the Torah, it doesn't go so well. I agree with the premise that God is only looking for a basic morality from the world, as evidenced by the comments that God makes multiple times, like before the flood, about being upset at the violence, at the theft, at the sexual immorality. Like, if they had been keeping to that, then things may have been different. But they weren't. Now, you're going to point out to me in response, well, even after the Torah is given, we weren't so hot.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is true. Yes, Rose.
Noah is very specific. They say Noah was the righteous amongst his people. Remember, he himself wasn't so 100% righteous. He was the most righteous of the lot.
Not necessarily. There is that idea. When it says that he was righteous in his generation, does that mean that only compared to his generation? But there's much more to be said about Noah. I'm not going to turn this one into a Noah class.
Okay.
If you email me later, I can send you a link, because it is something that I've talked about before. I'm a Noah fan, so you're not going to get that. You're not going to do that with me. Okay, so let's go to the other side of things now. Let's talk about what Marilyn raised, which is the question of numbers that are not really God's message to us. And the truth of the matter is that not every gematria is viewed by anyone as a message from God. They can be artificial messages from us to ourselves. They're not lucky numbers at all. There's no symbolism inherent in the number, but it conveys a message we value. And here I point you to Pirkei Avot. If you take a look at source number 7, a Mishnah in Avot, which is very vague and requires interpretation. The Mishnah says, Tikufot, which I translated here as either seasons or astronomical circuits. Let me explain what that means. It's not directly relevant for us, but it's good to know. Tell me something. When we dance on Simchas Torah with the Torah, what do we call that? Anybody know the term in Hebrew?
Hakafot.
Good. Hakafot or hakafos, depending on how you say it. That's correct. The term comes from a word meaning a circuit, to go around something, right? Because our classic hakafa is a circuit. There are reasons for that, not for discussion right now. But lahakif is to go around something. Sometimes it's to border something. A tikufa in Hebrew is a season. That's what we use the word to mean, but it really means a circuit. It's the earth on its path around the sun. That's what we are referring to. It's part of a cycle. So they use the word tikufa here. Either they mean seasons, or they mean astronomical circuits. It's not clear to me. And then they say gematria, or gematria-ot, which is the plural. And it says that gematria is parpera-ot la-chochma. Parperet is a term that comes from, it's a culinary term, it comes from meals. It either refers to an appetizer, or something that you eat along with the main course. But it's not the main dish. That's really the point. Gematria, as well as this astronomical study, is considered something that accompanies knowledge. So the question is, the first question is, what do you mean when you say gematria? And the sages are not in agreement on this. One view says gematria is like geometry. I mean, it's clearly from the Greek. It's not a Hebrew word. Don't kid yourself. It means geometry. And what it's telling you is geometry is a valuable but secondary kind of knowledge along with astronomy. Take a look at source number 8. Rabbi Menachem Meiri in his commentary on that Mishnah. And it said, the Mishnah said, that after one completes himself in the wisdom of the Talmud, he should begin other fields of study. And it said that the entree into those other fields of study is the sciences, the seasons or astronomical circuits and constellations and gematria ot, and hints to the study of mathematics and numbers and geometry and measurement. And from them, one will come to understand nature and the divine as is known to those who understand. If you really understand, you'll know that if you study these areas of the sciences, you will come to an appreciation of God and of nature. So he doesn't think this is about the numerical value of letters and words at all. He thinks that this Mishnah in Pirkei Avot is actually talking about math and science. And it's trying to tell you that those are things that will help you. Those are areas of knowledge that will help you on your way to understanding God. That's one view. However, if you flip to source number 9, you find a different view. Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach Duran. And he says, no, gematria here means what we think it means. It means the value of letters and numbers. And gematria ot, he says, is to calculate letters. Gematria is also the name in Latin, he says, for the study of calculations and measurements, which is the study of engineering. And this is not of actual law. And what he means by that, I should really explain. I should have explained it better in the text itself. What he means by that is that this gematria is not actually something that we use in Judaism in order to teach law. It's not really the source for our laws, and I'll explain it outside of the text, because I think it'll go better that way. There are times in Jewish law where the Talmud states a law and provides a derivation that seems to be a gematria. Like, how do you know that the law is X? I have a gematria that teaches me that. So he brings you as an example. If a person takes a vow to become a Nazir, right? Some of you were with me last year when we learned about Samson. Someone takes a vow to become a Nazir. Exactly, Roslyn, the hair. So what if a person says they're going to be a Nazir, but they don't say how long they're going to be a Nazir? They don't say how long you're going to be a Nazir. So the assumption is by default, it's 30 days. By default, it's 30 days. So says the Talmud. Where do we get that from? So there's a verse which talks about being a Nazir in the Torah, and it adds the term Nazir Yihyeh. Yihyeh, the Hebrew word Yihyeh, has the gematria of 30, and therefore it's 30 days. Because that word Yihyeh has the gematria of 30. So Rabbi Duran says, it's not that you only know the law because of the gematria. That's not really the way it works. He says, as I'm continuing on the second line in source number 9, the sages already knew that an unspecified period of Nazir, if he didn't say how long he's going to be a Nazir, is 30 days. They wanted to sharpen the students by linking this with the gematria of the word yeah is 30. But he says, we already knew it. We didn't need the gematria in order to teach the law. And he gives you another example that I'm going to skip just to keep things simple. And he concludes by saying, all of this is appetizer or accompaniment, not of the essence, like what Avot said. One does not receive reward for studying them as one receives for actual law. This isn't really true, authentic Torah. It's a nice message that we create. That's what a gematria is. He says, not always. He's not saying all gematria is that. But often it's just a nice mnemonic that we create, something that's helpful perhaps in terms of remembering things, but it's not a meaningful part of Torah in its own right. That's what Rabbi Duran suggested. And I'm gonna take questions in a minute, but I just want to show you the Torah Tamima. Right, Baruch HaLevi Epstein in source number 10 also makes this point. We have an idea which is already found in the Mishnah a couple of thousand years ago that there are 248 units in the body. The term unit is the best I can do for translating the word in Hebrew is aver. There are 248 avarim in the body. Some of those are soft tissue organs, some of those are bones, all sorts of different things. So he points out in source number 10, our sages regularly assign numbers from mundane issues as parallels to numbers of great associations and holiness. Like 248 commandments parallel to 248 body parts. And the like. So they take something that's relatively mundane. There are 248 different units of the body. And they say, and there are 248 commandments. Mitzvot aseh in the Hebrew. So he says, that's not a message from God. It's a message that we create. He has another passage where he, actually maybe there also, where he talks about the number 12 being used in that way. There are 12 tribes and there are 12 other things. But it's sometimes something that we create. Before we go further, and I know people are looking at the Who Knows One that's coming next, but just to make sure that this concept is clear, gematria may be a message from God, and therefore we can say 26 as a number represents this, 36 represents that, but often it's a message from ourselves. Yes, Mark.
Can it be a do-it-yourself project? Can I get up a calculator in order to prove something? Or do I have to actually just take what's in these sources and go by that?
Oh no, you can totally do it yourself. This is a do-it-yourself project.
Isn't it just open, like, you know, if I just start, I can almost prove anything. If I
you're not proving anything. As long as you understand that you're not proving anything. That's what the Mishnah and Avot is trying to say. This is something that you can use as a nice mnemonic. You know, I remember when I was, I don't know, 10 years old, my rabbi at the time, Rabbi Benjamin Blech, was the shul rabbi there. Some of you have probably read his articles online. They appear on aish.com. So he loves gematria. He loves gematria. I'm going to come back to that a little bit later on. And it inspired me. I was, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years old, something like that. And I decided that I was going to come up with the gematria of my Hebrew name. And so I came up with some outlandish thing that was connected. And I asked him about it. And he gave me a nice smile. Like, you know, very good. Like, okay. You're entitled to invent a gematria. Just don't make the mistake of thinking that it's God talking. You know, it's you talking. That's really the key. Roslyn, you were going to say?
Yes, I just wanted to, it keeps mentioning 204 commandments. It says it in source 10 and in an earlier source 2. I thought, how come it's 248? I thought we had 613.
Yeah, I was thinking that I should have said it, and I didn't.
No, before the body parts. It's in source number 3.
Yeah. No. I was thinking that I should have said it, and when I said it, I was thinking I should explain this, and decided not to. So thank you for calling me on it. The answer is 613 overall mitzvot, but there are two kinds of mitzvot. There are commandments, meaning go do this, and then there are prohibitions. Don't do that. So it's 248 do, and 365 don't do. They, the way that people often do it is they'll say positive commandment and negative commandment. But negative commandment sounds so bad. So they, so I take it as commandment versus prohibition. That's the idea.
Okay,
Marilyn.
Thank you.
Sure.
I don't know if this is relevant, but during the Second World War, and I was around, believe it or not, they used letters and turned them into numbers, and that became code for the war. Mm-hmm. Both Britain and America used that, so when you were changing the letters into numbers, that came to mind. That was really important. It may not have been Hebraic, but it was really important.
Yep.
And secondly, I want to say, although it isn't a number, the Torah uses a horoscope and satellites. For instance, you have to see the first star before Havdalah. They're using something other than the Lord's word. So I think we interpret according to our culture.
And the fact that we use three stars is because that's your definition of nightfall when you don't have the ability to see where the sun is relative to the horizon. Your definition of nightfall is it dark enough for me to be able to see stars? That's not, I would view that as somewhat different. Right, Janine?
You gave us a quote from the Torah, Tamima. He just says sometimes people do that, but is his conclusion that it's kind of a mnemonic?
That it often is. A mnemonic, a nice association. It's a fuller comment that he makes there. He's basing himself on a Gemara in Chagigah, Daf Yud Beis. If you take a look there, you'll see more. But he basically says our sages like to connect holy things with mundane, everyday things. And by using the number. Yeah. So, on a basic level... Sorry, Marilyn, you were going to say?
I was going to say, but it's basic to yourself. Children are born on the same day, that day becomes a lucky for you. So it's
so the question there will be, what are what's your justification for seeing that day as significant? That sounds to me like exception three, that it's about it being psychologically important. To me, this gives me a boost when I think of this day. So I want to stick to the educational ones right now, just as the category that we're in. The most basic kind is where you take a number and you use it to remember something from the Torah. In source number 11, I gave you a table of the classic Pesach song, Who Knows One. So one is God, two are the tablets, three is the fathers, four are the mothers, and so on and so on and so on. What I gave you in the last column in that table is a song that my kids and I made up on Sukkot a bunch of years ago. It's a Sukkot version of Who Knows One. So you start out with God, because God has pride of place, but there are two Aravot on Sukkot, and there are three Hadassim, and there are the Arba Minim, the four species, five books of the Pentateuch, because you have Simchas Torah, then 6 days when you shake the Lulav and Esrog, 7 days when you say Hoshanos, you have Shmini Atzeres is day 8, Simchas Torah is day 9, 10 days of repentance. I forget what we did for 11. We had something for 11. It might have been days of rain. I'm not sure. I think we had something for 11. 12, I think we did cucumbers, just because we didn't have anything. So there's 12 Malachafonaya. And then 13 are the bulls that they bring as a sacrifice on the first day of Sukkot. But you can actually go more. There's a 14 if you wanted to. The point is, you can come up with these educational associations. Sometimes, gematria is used to hint at the meaning of a biblical verse. And the king of these gematrias is the Baal HaTurim. Baal HaTurim is a short text composed by Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, who is best known as one of the leading authorities in Jewish law of all time. He wrote the book called The Tur, a compilation of Jewish law, which ended up being the framework for the Shulchan Aruch, for the Code of Jewish Law. Those of you who were with me last year when we learned about Rabbi Yosef Karo and his writing of the Code of Jewish Law, he was also a mystic, remember? So Rabbi Karo modeled himself on Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher's work. It's a very strict, and not strict, it's a very serious legal code. At the same time, he also writes the Baal HaTurim, And the Baal HaTurim is a series of short comments on biblical verses involving things like acronyms or pointing out whether where a word only appears a couple of times in Tanakh or gematrias. There's a story that I heard many years ago. I never verified it, but the story goes that there was a judgment in a rabbinical court. Somebody else claimed to be the author of the Torah, of the halachic work, the legal work that he had written. And it came to a rabbinical court, and the rabbinical court said, well, write something that can prove whether you're somebody who would have written the Torah or not. So the two of them go home, and he comes back the next day, and he has written overnight the Baal HaTurim, this work, which is a brilliant, brilliant work, and therefore the rabbinical court said, obviously, you're the author. But they're so different in style that it doesn't really make any sense. Proving you can do math and do acronyms doesn't prove you could write a legal code. I don't know. In any case, I brought you two examples from the Baal HaTurim. They're on last week's Torah portion because I thought we were going to do it last week. I overshot in it. So they're relevant for last week's Torah portion. The first one in source number 12 is when Joseph brings his brothers before the Pharaoh. So the biblical verse from Genesis chapter 47 says, and from the edge of his brothers, he took five men and he displayed them before Pharaoh. Joseph, of course, has 11 brothers, but he doesn't take them all. He only takes five from the edge. In the Hebrew, umikitzei echav lakach. So there's actually a great debate rabbinically as to what Joseph was doing when he took from the edge of his brothers. One school of thought says he took from the edge of his brothers the strongest. He wanted to intimidate the Pharaoh. That's one school of thought. The other school of thought is no, he took the weakest of the brothers because he wanted the Pharaoh to say, "Nah, I don't need these people. I don't want them in my army. Let them go off beyond their own." So, Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, in writing this Baal HaTurim, says, you know what? If you see the line with the Hebrew, the numerical value of umikitzei echav lakach, from the edge of his brothers he took, is the same as the numerical value for the word hachalashin, which means the weak. So, that tells you he took the weak. Now, as I gave you the numbers there, I did the math for you, it actually is off by one. Hachalashin is 403, not 404. However, those who are versed in gematria know that you can be off by one and we're still willing to accept it. Don't worry about it. One is Hashem. But that's one example. Another example in source number 13, where the biblical verse says that Pharaoh says to Joseph, the land of Egypt is before you. In the best of the land, place your father and your brothers. They will dwell in the land of Goshen. And the problem with this line is, if you're saying in the best of the land, then why do you then say Goshen? Why do you have two different identifications? So the Baal HaTurim, Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher, says if you count up the value of the word Goshen and the value of Bimeitav Haaretz, the best of the land, it actually is the same. So they're both saying the same thing. He doesn't mean that this is a biblical message to you. He means that this is our resolution of it, and it's a nice hint to the educational message. One last example of gematrias, because I don't want to get embedded in them. We have too much else to talk about. Is in source number 14. And this is a message that relates to Jewish law. The Talmud says we have 39 categories of what's called melacha, creative tasks, that we're not supposed to perform on Shabbat. 39 different kinds of activities. So sewing, for example, is one of them. Lighting a fire is one of them. 39 different categories. How do you know that it's 39? Where do you get that it's 39? So the Talmud quotes a verse. And Moses gathered the entire community of the children of Israel, and he told them, these are the items, the word in Hebrew is divarim, God has commanded you to do. for 6 days, melacha shall be performed, and then not on the seventh day, and so on. So the word that is used, these are the items, in Hebrew is ele hadivarim. So they do a complicated gematria. They say the word divarim, things, items, is a plural word. If I just had that, I would say that means there are two things you're not supposed to do on Shabbat. Take the minimum plural, and that's two. But there's a letter hey in front of it. Ha divarim. The extra letter hey means one more. That's now three. And then you have the word ele. These are the divarim. Well, ele, the numerical value of ele is 36. So therefore, if you add 3 and 36, you get 39. So it's 39 categories of malacha that are told to Moses at Sinai. If you didn't follow that, you're in good company. This is strange. And it is not meant to be, that's how you know there are 39. It's a nice mnemonic that they're giving you. If you can get this and keep it in your head, it's always a nice reminder and a hint from a verse that talks about not performing these tasks on Shabbat. As Rabbi Yoel ben Nun has pointed out, we have 39 different components of the tabernacle, of the Mishkan. And that is a closer association, potentially, because in this passage that I quoted you from Exodus chapter 35, it actually is in context about the building of the Mishkan and how the things you do to build the Mishkan are the things that you don't do on Shabbat. So it's the 30, you know, the Devarim and the Hay and the Eilat is just a message that we essentially create ourselves. You follow what I'm saying? Even if you don't follow that specific gematria, don't worry about it. It's the, you know, as we said in source number 8, it's an appetizer or an accompaniment. Source number 7 is an appetizer or accompaniment for knowledge. It's not the most important piece of this. Sometimes, I'm shifting now to talk about another type of number, another type of lucky number. Sometimes there are numbers that we invest with meaning for the sake of using them as a means of prayer to God. So we just talked about numbers that we invest with meaning as educational messages. But sometimes we actually invest it with meaning as a prayer to God. I'll give you an example, the number 72. 72 represents, I put it in source number 15, kindness. The Hebrew word is chesed. The gematria of the word chesed is kindness, is 72. So 72 happens to also be associated with one of the special names of God, but it's also chesed, it's kindness. And therefore, we associate that with some of our mitzvot. Example, take a look at source number 16. Source number 16 talks about the tzitzit. Okay, the tzitzit are the strings that are on the corners of a talis. Okay, that's a little bit of a mix. Tzitzit and talit, or tzitzit and talis. You can't mix them. But the strings that are on the corners of the garment. Each corner of the garment is, each corner of the garment has four strings that are doubled over to make 8. I would show you, except that I don't think it's going to work out well over the Zoom. But you have four strings that are doubled over to make 8. One of those strings is longer than all the others. And it wraps around the other strings, and you make knots, and then you wrap it around again, and make more knots, and wrap it around again. Can you visualize that? Maybe I should have brought a picture. I didn't think it as being so necessary, but maybe it would have been a little bit of a help. So, take a look at source number 16, where we're told that the number of wrappings is, you know, the number of times when you wrap that string around the others is actually flexible. One should not decrease to fewer than 7 wrappings, representing the 7 heavens, which is an idea that's an old idea in Judaism. One should not increase to more than 13 for the seven heavens and the six spaces between them. So no fewer than seven, no more than 13, says the Talmud, with a nice symbolism, which is important because if you remember the biblical text about the strings, it's supposed to have a blue string, and we're taught that the blue string reminds you of the sky. There's more to be said about that. But where I really wanted to go with it is source number 17, the Zohar, the essential mystical work in Judaism. Obviously, there are other mystical works, but not talking about what the Zohar is right now. But take a look. The Zohar says you have 18 for each corner. Because you have five knots, which is consistent always. You have five knots. And then you have 13 as your maximum number of wrappings on each corner. 5 plus 13 is 18. And then you do it on four corners of the garment. It's 72. That's what he says. So what? I have a verse in Isaiah chapter 16 which says that God's throne will be established upon kindness. Chesed. And the gematria of the word chesed is 72. So let me just sum that up because that's a little twisty, you know, not to make a pun on the tzitzis. But the idea here is that your tzitzit represent kindness because when you add up the knots and the wrappings on each corner, they add up collectively to 72, which is the numerical value of kindness. So when you wear the tzitzit, you are praying to God for kindness. That's the idea. You come up with this number as an association with kindness. I'll give you an example that's simpler. 91. 91 symbolizes God. Where do you get that? And how is that at all useful? Dr. Kirshen, thank you for your note in the chat, but I'm going to go through this because my head is going to spin if I start on that. But it's a fine invention. Take a look at source number 18. The word Amen in Gematria is 91. That's fairly straightforward. Three letters, Aleph, Mem, Nun, right? So so Amen in Gematria is 91. So what? There are two key names of God that are very common. One is the four-letter name that we talked about before that is 26. And the other one is the name that is pronounced Adonai. I put the dash in there within the name, as you see in source number 18. So if you add up the numerical value of the two names of God, you get 91. So that when you say Amen in prayer, Moshe, you're going to have to wait, sorry. When you say Amen in prayer, you are invoking the name of God. One more, and then I'll pause for questions and comments. 248. So I come back to Rosalind's point from before about the 248 commandments, not meaning all mitzvot, but 248 active commandments, things that you're supposed to do. So 248, when we use that in prayer, symbolizes the human body. Because as I mentioned before, we are taught that there are 248 units within the body. And if you take a look at source number 19, this may be familiar to some people here. We are taught to say Shema. The Torah says that you're supposed to say Shema in the morning and evening. But there are three words that get added at the start of Shema. If you look carefully in a Siddur, Kel Melech Ne'eman. Some people only say that if they're alone. I'm not going to go into that right now. Take a look at source number 19. Rabbi David Avudraham, also known as Abu Dirham, said, some say Kel Melech Ne'eman at the start of Shema because they want to have 248 words. Because I have a midrash that says the following. The verse in Proverbs says, guard my mitzvot, guard my commandments, and live. Guard the 248 words in Shema, and God will guard your 248 body parts. So I have a midrash that says that you're supposed to have 248 words in Shema in order to have the 248 body parts. The problem is that Shema is only 245. So they add Kel Melech Ne'eman in order to get to 248. Is everyone following what I'm saying here? This isn't too... Okay, we're good? The idea is, again, 248 symbolizes the human body. One more step in that, source number 20, Rabbi Chaim Vital, lead student of the Ari, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, says, no, you should know, that every spark of each and every soul must fulfill all 613 mitzvot. What he's talking about in context is reincarnation. And the idea that the soul may need to return multiple times, or sparks within a soul may need to return in order to check off all the boxes, to fulfill all of the mitzvot. He says, when one has not fulfilled all 613 mitzvot, which correspond to the 38 evarim, these 248 body parts, and 365 sinews, also within the body and within the soul, that soul is incomplete in its parts. Such a person is called blemished. He says, you have a blemish until you collect them all, until you do all 613. 248 body parts, 365 sinews is something I hadn't mentioned yet, but that's also part of this calculation. So that's what he says one has to do. There's so much more that you could do with this. But that's going to wrap up numbers that we invest with meaning. We've seen some lucky numbers. We've seen 26. For livelihood, 36, life in this world and the next. We've seen 72, representing kindness, 91, representing God, 248, representing the human body. So if someone wanted to pray for health, I suppose that may be useful. What I still want to do, and then I'm going to take questions and comments, I'm not running away, but what I want to do next time is to start out to talk about exception number two. Numbers which are not irrelevant omens, but they actually convey something significant about what we're counting. We're going to talk about 7 as an example of that, and the number 10 as an example of that. And we'll also talk about numbers that may not really be relevant to the item at hand, but they give us a psychological boost, and therefore we value them. So we'll talk about that also next time. All right, I'm going to take questions and comments. Moish. Moish, you're muted.
I love what you did with Chesed 72 and the Tzitzit. And I'm not meaning to be impish or devilish.
Sure.
But what do women do? In other words, is there some women thing that works the same way?
So I'm sure there is. I was thinking about it when I created this source sheet, that it was, you know, that's one that usually traditionally was male, without getting into the discussion of why and whether that's true in all parts of the Jewish world. But the example that I used was the one that I was familiar with. I'm fairly sure there is something to be found that's beyond, yes. Mark.
How much seriousness should we put into Gematria where it starts dictating behavior in Min Hagim, like nuts on Rosh Hashanah?
So the nuts on Rosh Hashanah we're going to get to. That's, I thought I actually had it on the source sheet, although I don't see it here. I wonder if I took it out at one point. I did plan to do the nut one. Why is it not here? Oh, there it is. It's in number 27. So we're going to talk about that one next week. In terms of changing one's customs in order to do that, that's a really good question, and it's been hotly debated over time. For example, the prayer of Baruch She'amar that is said traditionally in the morning, so some editions say that God is mehulal b'fi amo, and some editions say he is mehulal b'fe amo. Grammatically, it should be b'fi amo, for sure. Right? In the mouth of his nation, there's smichud, it should be befi amo. However, the befe amo is because the gematria of befe is paz, gold. And we're taught that there are 87 words in Baruch She'amar, and it's a valuable gematria. So you have some who are saying, stick to the gematria, I believe that's the older edition of the text. And you are others saying, no, you should correct it to make it grammatically correct. So it's been a discussion. It's not simple and straightforward for sure. You also find that Tanim, the Ashkenazi poets, not so much I think among the Sephardim, but the Ashkenazim certainly, where they would change words in their poetry because they wanted to come up with particular numerical references. So I'm not really answering your question as much as saying it's a good question. Marilyn, and then Ricky.
Well, just briefly, 72 also is four times life, so chesed and life go together. So
you got it. Well done. Well done. I expect to come back with a lot more gematrias from you next week. You can just send them to me and I can put them on the source sheet. We will have a full gematria session. Ricky.
72 is also the number of the names of God. If you take those three sentences by itself, it's from
yes.
Tomar.
Correct. There's a whole other thing about 72 in the name of God. I just didn't want to go there. But there's a lot that can be done with it. That is correct.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Anyone who has to go can go. It's 11 o'clock. I'm just going to stick around for a few minutes, recognizing that there are still more comments. I saw somebody unmute, but now I lost who it was. Everything shifted on my screen when Maribel left.
Me.
Ah, there you are. Yes. Go ahead.
It's impossible for anybody to do all 613 mitzvot. Some are for kings. Some
correct.
Are for women. Some are for whatever. So I don't know what he's talking about.
So that's why you're right. That's why he's talking reincarnation. What he's suggesting is that the soul has different sparks, parts of it, and that over time the soul comes back with its sparks in different bodies and will indeed end up fulfilling all 613 by having been in different bodies. Now you may answer me there haven't been 613 kings. So the answer is that the Zohar is dealing in mysticism, and in mysticism you can change the laws of physics as you go. And the sparks that the Zohar is talking about can inhabit one body, one soul can be in many sparks, many souls can have sparks that are shared, but somehow that's the way it works. The Zohar has a complex theory of how all of this plays out. It also uses that to answer the question that people ask, if there's reincarnation, and we're taught biblically that in the end, people are going to come back to life, the resurrection of the dead, but all these souls that were reincarnated have multiple bodies. So which body is going to come back? So the Zohar suggests that each spark comes back in the body in which it perfected itself. So each spark had its own role, each body had its own role, and it comes back in that entity. This is way too deep for me, but that's the idea.
Are you talking about tikkun?
Sorry, what, Ricky?
Are you talking about tikkun?
Essentially, yes. Essentially, yes. Okay, other questions and comments?
Thank you.
All right, then thank you very much. Next week we will... Shkarach to you. Next week we'll wrap up these gematrias and the numbers that have different meanings, like I said. We might also, maybe I'll take a detour, and we'll talk about pi, the calculation of pi in the Talmud, since that fits under numbers also.
Yeah, we can also talk about mazal. What do you mean by luck? Because in Mazal
Israel,
you said lucky numbers.
Wait, so that's a different thing. That's really astronomy and astrology. So it's really a different field. We'll see if I can fit it in, but it's it really
but
is
what
a
is luck?
Its own thing.
What is luck? Lucky numbers?
Right, so really what we're talking about here is people reading meaning into numbers that aren't practically relevant to the item at hand. That's a separate issue which comes under the biblical prohibition. The same biblical prohibition that's saying don't read omens is also not going to like reading the horoscope, because it'll say that that's not relevant also. So in that sense, it fits. Maybe I'll be able to make it fit. We'll see.
So it would say that something is left.